Ladies and gentlemen, we have very good news indeed. The Attorney General of the United States has sent a message to the staff employees of the Department of Justice. He is fine and plans to be back at work this afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. Please, those coming in, please continue and join us. In the early days of the Roberts Court, a number of commentators have focused attention on the court's apparently new interest in business cases. Now, this fascination is hardly surprising in light of the relative paucity of business-related cases before the court in more recent years. While the court under Chief Justice Rehnquist was generally considered, in the words of Washington Post reporters Robert Barnes and Carrie Johnson, quote, quite a good forum for business, for two decades, according to Business Week, notice the impressive nature of my authorities, it, quote, it, the court, simply wasn't interested in business cases, instead favoring taking cases involving criminal law, school prayer, or other matters involving fundamental constitutional rights. In fact, in the later years of the Rehnquist Court, one observer lamented, this again from Business Week, quote, you couldn't buy an antitrust or securities case onto the docket to save your life. Well, beginning with Chief Justice Roberts' appointment, the court has been noticeably more receptive to these kinds of cases. And the catalyst has presumably been the appointment of Chief Justice Roberts, known as, with Carter here, whom I'll introduce momentarily, as a go-to lawyer for the business community during his days at Hogan and Hartson. According to Business Week, Chief Justice Roberts is, quote, more interested in business issues and understands them better than Chief Justice Rehnquist did. Whether the elevation of Justice Alito from the Court of Appeals is likewise partially responsible for this sort of increased business civil litigation caseload is less certain. But we do know that, at a minimum, both of the new members of the court had, quote, the business community's stamp of approval during confirmation hearings. Whatever the reason for this relative shift in the docket, here is the concluding observation of one reporter. There has been a sea change brought about by Chief Justice Roberts, stemming directly from his willingness to take business cases for review. But is more actually at work here? 2 years ago, in an important article in the Texas Law Review, Professor Andrew Singel found that the Rehnquist Court had a theme running through its jurisprudence that seemed not fully understood by court watchers and historians. And the theme was hostility more generally to civil litigation. Professor Singel dubbed the Rehnquist Court, quote, the court against the courts. His research showed what he viewed as, quote, profound hostility toward the institution of civil litigation and a concomitant skepticism as to the ability of litigation to function as a mechanism for organizing social relations and collectively administering justice. As he put it, the Rehnquist Court's popular narratives of federalism, conservatism, and judicial supremacy simply fail to recognize the anti-litigation undercurrent that affected, perhaps, and even produced many of the court's important decisions. Well, that was the Rehnquist Court, but we're talking about the Roberts Court. Well, Professor Singel has a blog, and he noted in a... Why do you laugh? Where do you get your information? He noted toward the end of the October 2006 term that the, quote, the anti-litigation theme of the Roberts Court is thus far the great underappreciated story. He identified a reignited struggle between the court's members over the role of litigation. He remarked, there seems to be a more concerted pushback against the Roberts Court anti-litigation orientation than there was during the latter years of the Rehnquist Court. He called this a titanic struggle between very sharply competing visions, and in that it was the first big storyline of the Roberts era. You know, it is with incredible ill grace that a speaker quotes himself or herself. But why not? In a recent article in the Pepperdine Law Review, the dean of... Thank you. The dean of that venerable institution wrote, "The Roberts Court is not so much pro-business as it is massively skeptical of civil litigation, especially nationwide civil litigation. This skepticism cuts across the usual ideological lines in the court. It appears that the court, in terms of commercially significant cases, is seeking to address what it perceives as an overarching problem of arbitrariness and caprice that is the modern civil justice system." Very harsh words by the dean. To address these issues and to perhaps rebut what I have said, but certainly to illuminate the Roberts Court in this very important part of its jurisprudence, we're delighted and honored to have five enormously distinguished commentators. I've referred to Carter, but let me, honor to whom honor is due, say that Carter Phillips is the managing partner of the Washington, D.C. office of Sidley Austin, LLP. He was a law clerk to Chief Justice Warren Burger and served as assistant to the Solicitor General for 3 years in the early 1980s under the venerable Rex Lee. Since joining Sidley, Carter has argued, where'd Carter go? There he is. 60? 61 cases. How about a round of applause for that? And not to count, but how many in the courts of appeals?
Somewhere over 70.
You get the idea. So he speaks with authority and not as the scribes. The Honorable Gregory G. Katsas. Greg is the Assistant Attorney General of the United States for the Civil Division. He argues roughly one case a day, by my count. He has also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, as the Principal Deputy Associate Attorney General, and as the Acting Associate Attorney General of the United States. You get the idea. He understands the Department of Justice. He has argued or supervised many of the leading civil appeals involving the federal government since a very important year, 2001. Having argued over, 40 is the number I have, over 40 appeals. Robert S. Peck is president of the Center for Constitutional Litigation, PC, a law firm dedicated to challenging laws that impede access to justice. We look forward to his remarks in that respect. Mr. Peck also serves as a member of the adjunct law faculties at AU and George Washington, where he teaches an advanced constitutional law seminar, and he alternates between those two splendid law schools. He's argued cases in the U.S. Supreme Court and the Supreme Courts of numerous states. He is also the author of several books and numerous articles. The Honorable Jerry E. Smith, fellow Texan. Judge Smith was appointed United States Circuit Judge for the Fifth Circuit in 1987 and then entered on duty in 1988. So 20 years on the bench. He's double Yale, lots of years under the elms in New Haven, a BA and JD. He was a law clerk for United States District Judge Halbert Woodward in the Northern District of Texas, but his professional career, including his judicial service, has been in Houston as a partner at Fulbright & Jaworski, a city attorney, and numerous, numerous accomplishments in that city as well as in the nation. Dr. Roger Pilon. Roger is a true doctor. Yes, he is a juris doctor, but that doesn't count. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago. He's vice president for legal affairs at Cato Institute, where he holds the B. Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies. He's the founder and director of Cato's Center for Constitutional Studies and the publisher of the Cato Supreme Court Review. He's also an adjunct professor of government at Georgetown through the Fund for American Studies. Dr. Pilon's writings have appeared in the nation's major media, and he is a frequent guest on radio and television. Would you join me in welcoming this panel with an enthusiastic round of applause? I have the privilege now of being the timekeeper. Here is the division of time. We'll be going in the order from my right to left. Carter Phillips will be chatting about punitive damages, preemption, the increased number of business cases on the docket. Greg Katsas will be talking about employment cases, interestingly enough, and perhaps others as the spirit moves him. Bob Peck will be speaking about punitive damages and the tension between pro-business and states' rights sympathies. Judge Smith will respond to a good deal of what has been said before, and then our cleanup batter will be Roger. Join me in welcoming Carter Phillips.
First of all, obviously, it's a pleasure to be here. If you ever get an opportunity to choose the person who introduces you, I would strongly recommend the dean at Pepperdine as somebody to choose. He does a wonderful job of it. Thanks, Ken, so much. I thought I'd start a little bit by giving a bit of perspective on the nature of the court's docket in terms of interest in business cases. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm about 99% sure that the person who made the comment to Business Week that you couldn't get cert granted in an antitrust or securities case if your life depended on it was me. Because, you know, one of the disadvantages of my practice is that trying to get Supreme Court review of any issue is always a difficult task since the court has for some time been somewhere around 75 to 80 cases out of a request of 8,000. If the court shows a bias against any particular area, it is pretty much devastating. And the reality is, at the tail end of the Rehnquist court, it really was virtually impossible to get them interested in what I think the business community, at least, would regard as the core of the business docket. But in the last two terms of the Roberts court, in the 2006 term, of the 80 cases that were, approximately 80 cases that were argued and decided that term, 28 of them were what the business community would have regarded as business cases. In some ways, I can almost immediately define what's a business case by who hires me to file a brief in it. So since we filed briefs in most of those cases, I'm pretty sure that they were, in fact, all business cases. I saw Robin Conrad's here, so I was originally going to say nasty things about the chamber, but instead I'll shift gears immediately and point out that 12 of the 14 cases in which the chamber filed a brief that term, they prevailed. So it was not only a busy term on the business docket, but also one that was remarkably successful enough that the New York Times had a separate article in its magazine worrying about the undue influence, perhaps, of the chamber with respect to the court. So I suppose that's why we, in 2007, while the size of the case or the number of cases didn't change dramatically, 24 out of about 68 cases, the business community only won 13 out of 24. So there was a bit of an evening of that. And one of the things that's worth talking about is sort of what might explain why it is that if this is a pro-business court, why on at least some occasions, the business community doesn't prevail. But before I do that, I think I'd like to make at least a couple comments about, you know, what would explain this. Obviously, the dean has already identified the chief justice, and I think that there's little question that he has to have had a pretty significant thumbprint on this particular development. And I would say so for three reasons. The first one Ken already alluded to, which is that the chief does, in fact, come from a business-oriented background in his practice. He does understand these issues quite well. I think he recognizes which questions need to be resolved by the court. Two, as the Chief Justice, he gets to set the discuss list for the conferences in which the court decides which petitions to grant and which ones not to, and he gets to discuss them in the first instance. And whatever else John Roberts was as an advocate, he was a spectacular oral advocate. And so, therefore, having the opportunity to present those cases and to express his views as to why particular issues might be worthy of certiorari strikes me as something that would have a tremendous influence on justices who might otherwise not have much of a background in that area and would, I think, be inclined to defer to him. And then finally, I've always thought that the one power that the Chief Justice obviously has is the power of appointment. So if you had doubts about whether you'd go along with the Chief's recommendation on a cert petition, it might be worth doing it just so you don't end up writing longshoremen's cases for the next 10 years. So, I don't know for sure that he would use that influence, but if I were sitting in the room, that'd be in the back of my mind. So as a consequence of that, there has been, up until this term, a pretty dramatic uptick in the business docket. I think actually this term, it's a little harder to tell. There seemed to be a significant number of criminal law cases that have picked up. Going into the term, there was also a much larger uptake in cases. The court was almost on a pace to get to 100 this term, but unfortunately, it sort of ran out of steam once they came back from the summer. I guess they lost their enthusiasm for it. So it looks like they're going closer to the 80 cases. You know, as far as the principle of the skepticism about litigation, I have to say I agree completely with Ken's assessment that this cuts across ideological lines. The two most sort of definitive opinions on this, one was written by Justice Kennedy and the other one by Justice Souter. Justice Kennedy in Stone Ridge, which is the sort of indirect liability case under 10b-5, it's actually scheme liability, had a whole section of his opinion that addresses the problems of litigation and the difficulties they pose to the business community generally, and in the securities context, the difficulties that they would pose for the efficient operation of our markets. Now, I know everybody who really cares about the efficient operation of our markets is in our competitor meeting at this point, so you're probably not as interested in that topic, but all of us have watched our competitive markets take a tumble lately, and I don't think we can throw that at the feet of securities litigation, but there's no question that for a very long time, securities problems did interfere with the securities litigation problems did interfere with those markets. And Justice Kennedy wrote a very, I thought, a powerful opinion expressing the court's general skepticism about that. And while Stone Ridge was a 5-3 decision, so it was somewhat more closely divided than some others, it nevertheless was a very solid majority in that particular context. The second case is the Exxon opinion last term, written by Justice Souter, and again, in his treatment of the punitive damages portion of the Exxon case, which you'll recall deals exclusively with the common law analysis, in which he really does the kind of traditional common law, let's analyze the policies undergirding punitive damages and the problems that may arise in that context. He was very clear in his expressions of serious doubt about litigation as a mechanism for properly deciding the kinds of issues that punitive damages in fact resolve. And so you have Justice Souter, you have Justice Kennedy. These are not, this is not an ideological divide, at least as far as I can tell. In addition to that, you know, in the Twombly and the Tellabs case, Twombly was the antitrust case, which I think is probably maybe the most important decision the court's handed down, at least in the non-constitutional realm, in quite some time, where they literally modified significantly the rules for satisfying, for getting past a motion to dismiss and the filing of a complaint. Well, it comes up in the context of a fairly complicated antitrust case, which by itself is, you know, would have been unusual. It might not have come up in the Rehnquist court, but it does come up in the Roberts Court, and then the court takes advantage of the opportunity to render a much higher threshold for being able to move on to the next stage of litigation, and again defends that on the basis that litigation is extraordinarily expensive. It has extreme deterrent impact on a lot of, in that context, in the antitrust context, pro-competitive behavior, and therefore, as a consequence, you know, the court dealt with it as an antitrust case, but actually has rendered a decision that's probably been cited more than almost any case in recent memory. Tellabs is the securities case in which the court gave a more heightened standard for the pleadings, for pleadings in the securities context. But there, all the court was doing was interpreting a special rule that Congress had adopted that, in fact, raised the standards. The Seventh Circuit had written an opinion that it sort of drifted back toward the traditional approach to motions to dismiss. And the court simply said, no, that's not the right standard in order to get to the next stage in securities litigation, again, recognizing that once you get past the motion to dismiss, the costs of the litigation are enormous and in many ways can be counterproductive, that the court would enforce that with some recognition of its skepticism about, you know, the value of courts as the process for trying to resolve a wide range of those disputes. The two other areas I want to spend a minute or two on, one is in the punitive damages context. The reason I find the punitive damages issues fascinating in this court is that the Roberts Court has so far gone to great lengths to avoid resolving the substantive due process issue in the punitive damages context. Most of you will probably remember that in the State Farm case some years ago, the court, in a 6-3 decision, so it wasn't a strict ideologically divided opinion, concluded, and indeed there was a strange ideological divide in that case, in a 6-3 decision said that if you have a substantial compensatory award, in that case $1 million, that the presumptive ratio for punitive damages should be 1-1, which for most of the business community was welcome news, because we've been litigating these issues for a very long time. Tort reform efforts and punitive damages had been met with extraordinary resistance either at the legislative level or even when you succeeded in getting legislation. A lot of times it was stricken by state Supreme Courts on state constitutional grounds. And so having the court available to provide a significant check through the due process clause is extremely important to the business community. The interesting part about, of course, the 6-3 State Farm decision is that the dissenting justices are Justices Thomas and Scalia, along with Justice Ginsburg, because the two, quote, ideological conservative justices don't recognize that there is a substantive due process role to play in the punitive damages context. So the question then becomes, after State Farm, what happens? Well, I doubt that there are very many decisions by the Supreme Court that have been as routinely ignored in lower courts as State Farm. There are very seldom do you see 1-1 punitive damage ratios. The court made reference to 9-1 punitive damage ratio, so that tends to be sort of more of the linchpin or the touchstone of the lower court's analysis. But, you know, for those of us in the business community who were hoping that 1-1 number, set of numbers were going to hold, you'd be sorely disappointed. And we've been waiting for the court to return to that issue to ringingly re-endorse the notion that 1-1 really is the right approach to take. And the court has had three punitive damages cases now in the last three terms. The Philip Morris case, Williams, which is the Oregon state court case, in which Justice Breyer wrote the opinion for the court that said that you cannot award punitive damages for injuries suffered by third parties, but you can make the award of punitive damages reflect the injury to third parties. If that's not angels dancing on the head of a pin, I don't know what is. But, you know, presumably there's some distinction there that's meaningful. And in any event, the punitive damage award there, which was, I think, 79-1 off of a significant compensatory award, was set aside, sent back to the Oregon Supreme Court. In the interim, then, the court gets the Exxon case, in which the substantive due process issue is posed. It expressly declines to decide that issue, doesn't grant certiorari on the separate question, grants it solely on the common law issue, and decides the common law issue, again, with a pretty strong reinvigoration of this 1-1 notion, but only very consciously as a common law principle. And now, this coming term, the Oregon Supreme Court, undaunted, decided that the previous instructions from the Supreme Court didn't prevent them from reinstating the previous large punitive damage award. The case comes back to the Supreme Court, but the issue here is whether or not the state can use a state procedural ground as an excuse not to essentially comply with a Supreme Court mandate. And again, the substantive due process issue is posed, and the court again declines to grant certiorari on that issue. So the question out there is, you know, where are the chief and Justice Alito on these issues? Are they more like Justices Scalia and Thomas in the sense that they don't want to play in the due process playground, or are they going to be more like perhaps the justices they replaced, Justice O'Connor and Chief Justice Rehnquist, who were, particularly in O'Connor's case, probably the strongest advocates of due process limits on on punitive damages. So that, to me, is sort of one of the big issues that is still out there and that needs to get resolved. I'll take 30 seconds to deal with the preemption issues. Last term was an interesting one on preemption because in the last 10, 15 years, you get a lot of rhetoric on both sides about the presumption against preemption and treating it as a core federalism issue where majestic forces are at stake. Interestingly, in the five cases the court handed down last term on preemption, each of them was dealt with on a very sort of pro forma statutory interpretation issue. No mention at all of the presumption against preemption, simply analyzing the statute to see whether or not it was a serious conflict or whether or not there was an express preemption provision that ousted the state law under those circumstances. And again, you wonder how much of a difference is there in the outlook between the Chief Justice now and his predecessor, Rehnquist, and Justice Alito and his predecessor, O'Connor. The former two, very much states' rights oriented, particularly Justice O'Connor, who grew up in that environment, whereas by contrast, Justice Alito has literally spent his entire professional career as a federal employee. And so is it likely that he has anywhere near the same enthusiasm for the state's concerns that his predecessor had? It seems to me it's an open question, but you don't certainly see the same kind of rhetoric from him so far that I thought was a clearly visible in Justice O'Connor's question. So, you know, the bottom line is it's good news in general for the business community, but there are countervailing considerations. There are certain ideological cross currents. I wish I could say it's all good news for the business community, since those are the people I generally represent. But I would say it's much better news than not, and I'll quit on that.
My own view is that the Roberts Court, for the most part, is a pretty cautious and incrementalist court. It's a little bit early to draw too many generalizations after two and a half terms. But I do think it would be a bit of an overstatement to characterize that court as consistently or definitively conservative, pro-defendant, pro-government, pro-employer, pro-business, and so on. Let me discuss mainly a couple of employment cases, and then I hope have a few minutes to comment on some of the other business cases that Carter mentioned and then maybe even some non-business civil cases that I deal with that I think might have some bearing on the topics we're discussing. Employment cases. In October term 2006, the big cause celeb was a case called Ledbetter on statute of limitations issues in the Title VII context. Lilly Ledbetter ended up a regular in the Democratic Convention and on the campaign trail, and her case generated a lot of heated commentary and allegations that the court was rolling back protections for employees and so on. I don't think that's fair. I think Ledbetter is a pretty narrow and straightforward application of existing precedent. The general rule reflected in no fewer than 4 cases stretching back 30 years was that in order to fit within a limitations period, a Title VII plaintiff had to identify a specific act of discrimination that A, occurred within the limitations period, and B, was motivated by discriminatory animus. And they've said that time and again in various contexts. They had also created an exception to that general rule for hostile environment claims on the theory that it's really not realistic to talk about, to break down a hostile environment claim into a series of discrete acts that are independently actionable and can be mapped onto specific time frames for accrual purposes. So doctrinally, the question in Ledbetter is whether pay claims are more like the garden variety general rule that I've described, or whether they are more akin to hostile environment claims for purposes of these limitations and accrual rules. Doesn't sound like the kind of stuff that should have people marching in the streets. And I think the court's conclusion that they are subject to the general rule rather than the exception was, I think, the better reading of existing precedent, but certainly a defensible reading, and certainly nothing that would warrant the rather spectacular charges that were leveled against the court in the wake of that decision. In October term 2007, the term just concluded, I think the biggest issue on the employment docket were a couple of retaliation cases. And there, employers lost both cases. The cases both were about the general issue of whether anti-discrimination prohibitions in federal law carry with them an implied prohibition on retaliation against people who complain about or report or are witnesses in discrimination cases. As an original matter, one might have thought that those concepts are pretty distinct, but in two cases last term, the court said no. One involving a private employer where I think in fairness to the court, its decision reflected a fairly modest extension of pro-employee precedents. Nothing too dramatic there. A little bit more striking to me was the federal government case involving the age discrimination statute, where we lost that case having a lot more arrows in our quiver than simply the general proposition that employment discrimination and retaliation are conceptually distinct, and a statute prohibiting the one shouldn't be construed automatically to prohibit the other. We had that general argument, but we also had a structural argument based on the particular provisions of the age discrimination statute, in which, with respect to private employers, the statute specifically distinguished between discrimination and retaliation and set out express causes of action for both, and then had separate, somewhat parallel provisions with respect to the federal government, except the federal government provisions had an anti-discrimination provision, but not an anti-retaliation provision. And one would think, looking at that structure, there's an awfully good inference that Congress did not want retaliation claims against the government. Above and beyond that, we had a further argument about sovereign immunity, that all of this, as to federal employers, should be viewed through that lens, giving the government an extra thumb on the scale. And finally, we had the point that none of the plaintiffs suing the federal government for retaliation would be out of court, because if they didn't have a claim under the Age Act, as we argued, they could do what every federal employee does with respect to any kind of retaliation claim, which is bring a claim under the Civil Service Reform Act, which has a series of very elaborate and reticulated administrative and judicial review provisions for folks who want to challenge unjustified actions taken against them in the context of federal employment. So we wouldn't have left anyone out of court in that context. And notwithstanding all of that, the court ruled against us, 6-3, in an opinion written by Justice Alito. So I don't see any basis for drawing a general conclusion that this is a consistently pro-employer court. More briefly, on some of the other business-related contexts, punitive damages, Carter mentioned the Philip Morris case. I don't view that as having that much significance, because I agree with his angels on the head of a pin point that in practical application, the difference between punishing for harms inflicted against a non-defendant and the difference between considering those harms as an aggravating circumstance in judging the reprehensibility of a defendant's conduct as to the plaintiff in court is not likely to drive a lot of jury outcomes in a lot of obvious ways. And the Exxon case, it's a good case for defendants to have Justice Souter embracing the one-to-one proposition, but it's a bit of an oddball case in that it is the court applying its own common law powers in the admiralty context, and that seems to me more likely to be an outlier set of facts than the cases that business folks probably care a lot more about, which involve the federal due process limits, if any, on punitive damages awards in state court. And in that context, I agree with Carter. I think the jury is still out because you have Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, who on a very rough cut might be thought to be pro-business, sort of very hostile to business interests in those cases because they're very hostile to substantive due process. And you have federalism considerations which might animate some of the generally pro-business justices tend to be pro-federalism justices. And so I completely agree there are cross-cutting issues there. And I don't think we've seen anything dramatic yet, and I'm not sure how those issues will come out. Securities, Stone Ridge case, good case for defendants, but keep in mind the court already had held some years ago that there was no aiding and abetting liability under Rule 10b-5, and the defendants in Stone Ridge, who were customers and purchasers of the company whose securities were at issue, sort of look a lot more like classic aiders and abettors than like classic defendants who would be primarily liable, and it seems to me Stone Ridge is largely an attempt to avoid an end run around the central bank holding as to aiding and abetting. One area in which I do think there's a very clear and striking trend is the antitrust cases. Defendants do very well in those cases, and we've seen that manifested in Twombly on pleading standards. In my capacity as the civil division head, I very much hope that the court's discussion of Rule 12b-6 will have implications beyond antitrust cases, but clearly part of what's driving Twombly is the antitrust-specific notion that you have to be careful about what inferences you'll permit lest pro-competitive conduct be deterred. Ligon, a case where they overruled the last vestige of per se scrutiny of vertical price restraints. But I think the antitrust cases are not so much a three-year trend reflecting appointment decisions of this president, so much as really a 30-year trend reflecting the ascendancy of Judge Bork and Judge Posner's view that antitrust is fundamentally about protecting competition and ensuring efficiency as against the competing view that it is a device for protecting small individual competitors who might be hurt by competition. Finally, let me just mention some non-business cases that I pay attention to that I think might be relevant for some of the broader discussion here. Sometimes the claim is made that this is an activist court bent on changing a lot of precedent dramatically. That doesn't seem right to me, and if you look at October term 2006, that was an incredibly striking term for what I will loosely call left-leaning precedents that the Supreme Court did not, emphasis not, overrule. In Seattle schools on race-based school assignments, declining to overrule Grutter and Gratz, and Justice Kennedy distancing himself from some of the more aggressive aspects of the plurality opinion. The partial birth abortion case in which the court upheld a federal statute but went out of its way not to overrule a precedent on a seemingly indistinguishable state statute that they had struck down. A campaign finance case in which they struck down some restrictions on issue ads, but again went out of their way not to overrule McConnell versus FEC a couple years ago, broadly upholding the McCain-Feingold statute. And finally, the Hine case on taxpayer standing in Establishment Clause cases, where the court granted the executive a certain degree of latitude to conduct programs without Establishment Clause litigation, but again went out of its way not to overrule the Bettnor precedent of Flass versus Cohen. Final point, with respect to the point that this court is fundamentally against civil litigation and suspect of it as a means for resolving disputes, there certainly is that tug in a lot of these cases, but I have to say the single most important decision that the Roberts Court has issued, perhaps by an order of magnitude, is one in which, for the first time in American history, they struck down a wartime statute embraced by Congress and the President as Commander-in-Chief in order to permit hundreds of aliens captured outside the country and held as enemy combatants to bring civil litigation in the district courts in Washington, which is tying this government and this war effort up in knots. I find it hard to believe that a court that could inflict that kind of precedent on us could fairly be described in any across-the-board way as being skeptical of civil litigation, even though Boumediene is not a business case.
First, let me thank the Federal Society for inviting me to join this panel. And to start off with a general view, I've got to say I agree with much of what Carter said about why there's been an influx of business cases. I think a lot of it has to do with the existing perspective that John Roberts had with his persuasive ability with respect to the brethren, and also one other factor that wasn't mentioned, and I think that there was a certain amount of pent-up demand that these are issues that kept coming and coming to the court, knocking on the door, and the door wasn't opening. And I think that for that reason alone, a lot of the cases were accepted. I also suspect, as a student of the court's history, that reasoning will dissipate over time, and we will see fewer business cases as the court again begins to really define itself, which I think it has not yet done. Now, one area that we've discussed a little bit is punitive damages. And punitive damages are the modern obscenity. In the late 50s and the late 60s, the court struggled with obscenity and how to define it, and we had Potter Stewart's famous statement that he knows it when he sees it, and the court actually practiced that because they would actually view the films that were a subject. Even John Harlan, who was blind at the time, felt duty-bound to sit through the theater and the watching of these films, and Thurgood Marshall assigned to himself the task of describing what was going on screen to the blind Justice Marshall, Justice Harlan. Now, today, the court is in basically that same situation. They keep seeing it. It raises a judicial eyebrow. They wonder what to do about punitive damages. At the same time, they struggle with it. And Exxon is a great example of that because here they were exercising maritime law where they can make the common law. And here was an opportunity to do something about punitive damages in that unusual context. And nonetheless, for a court that generally is regarded as pro-business, they approved a $507 million punitive damage award for conduct which they found not terribly reprehensible. They found that Exxon had been basically a good citizen throughout the process after the spill, and therefore they said even in those situations, one-to-one makes sense to them. Now, that, I think, is unusual. And that also means that maybe the one-to-one doesn't have a lot of application where the conduct is more egregious. And so that's something to consider here. Another interesting thing about the Exxon decision is a footnote in which they took a study of punitive damages done by some very good scholars, and they said because it had been funded by Exxon, they were going to give it no credit at all. And that also was a very interesting thing with broader implications beyond this case. Finally, one other thing. The court did go out of the way, in Justice Souter's opinion for the majority, did go out of the way to talk about the empirical evidence about punitive damages, not in maritime cases, but more generally. And he said that despite the fact that for years, basically, we were convinced that punitive damages were skyrocketing, we find that they're not really that big of a problem, that most punitive damage awards were less than a one-to-one ratio. And so that was something that was remarkable, that the court, after having gotten amicus briefs from empirical scholars on both sides for years and years and years, suddenly came to that conclusion in this case. Nonetheless, he said, it's the inconsistency, the outliers that we have to be concerned about. Now, most social scientists will tell you, don't worry about outliers, but the court does. The missing part of the analysis, which was interesting, is that the outliers were almost uniformly the low compensatory award cases, which the court has traditionally said would support higher ratios. So even when having spent some time to try to understand the empirical evidence, it seems that the court did not yet do that. The other case, and obviously the court has found that the prurient interest in this case is just tremendous, is the Philip Morris versus Williams case. Oh, one more point before I leave Exxon. I had a cert op. Now, denial of cert is not any indication of the court's view, but I had a cert op that was pending and held during the course of the Exxon Valdez case, a case called Continental Carbon versus Action Marine. And even though the term Action Marine might lead you to think it might be a maritime case, it was not. But this was a case in which there was a $2 million compensatory award and a $17.5 million punitive damage award. And the petition for certiorari claimed that there really, because of the substantial award, was a constitutional maximum of 1-to-1. And when the court held that for almost 9 months during the course of the Exxon decision, we were concerned that maybe they were going to use Exxon in precisely the manner that that Carter had hoped, and would remand on a GVR to the 11th Circuit to apply whatever principles they enunciated in Exxon. But 2 days after the Exxon decision came down, they denied cert. So while we don't know, they just didn't think this was a vehicle for deciding that question or not, but it leads me to think that the one-to-one did not have much gravitational pull outside of maritime law. Philip Morris versus Williams, it's my case. So, and we're only on our third trip up to the U.S. Supreme Court in this case. So, I'm not sure whether it's just they can't, they love this case or they love to hear me argue it. But last time up, we thought the excessiveness issue was the main issue, and that's where most of the briefing was. The court didn't seem to be terribly interested in that issue. In fact, Justice Breyer, who was the author of the 5-4 majority, and I agree with Greg and Carter that the court moved the ball not at all, but Justice Breyer was the author for the 5-4 majority, and during the course of oral argument, he said, 100-to-1 doesn't bother me if the behavior's, as he put it, bad enough. And so, therefore, it doesn't seem like the court's ready to tackle that issue. It's a hard issue for them. You know, the due process clause doesn't speak in terms of mathematics, and asking courts to engage in an elementary school exercise of mathematics does not seem to be the mandate that you draw from due process. So, nonetheless, they looked at this as a way to deal with it procedurally. And so they did come up with this approach to harm to non-parties that I think is best illustrated by the scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz when he's pointing in both directions simultaneously. The fact of the matter is that the court said you may not punish directly for harm to others, but you may consider harm to others in terms of the reprehensibility of the act. And, of course, the reprehensibility of the act remains the most important indicia of the size of the punitive damage award. So if you think that that advances the ball at all, you'll have to explain it to me because I can't figure that one out. Nonetheless, we return to Oregon because the standard the court set was that upon request, a defendant gets an instruction like that. And as Justice Scalia said during oral argument, now, you know, sending it back on that kind of a ground might not satisfy anybody because Oregon might find other reasons to reject the request, which is exactly what Oregon did. For 92 years, Oregon has had a rule that says that all proposed jury instructions must be clear and correct in all respects. And so if any part of it is incorrect, the entire instruction gets rejected. This is part of the party presentation principle, and you depend on parties because when you get up to an appellate court and the instruction's been requested, it's not error to reject an instruction that would have instructed the jury in the wrong terms, wrongly about the law. And so that's what Oregon did. Now, the question presented this time, there were two questions presented. One was the excessiveness issue, which the court did not accept, and the other is basically whether the Oregon Supreme Court defied the U.S. Supreme Court in restoring this award. And, you know, it's not a mere 79-1, it's a mere 97-1. So I don't see what the problem is. But anyway, the fact is that it's clear, despite the scope of that award, that is not the primary concern of the court. And as Greg said, I think that any jury that actually heard this instruction would have not changed their verdict one iota. And in fact, Justice Scalia suggested during oral argument that they might have increased it because the instruction actually didn't quite say what the court said, but actually told them that they could take harm to others into account in deciding the reasonable relationship of the award, which seems to me like encouraging them to multiply by the number of unnamed victims out there. And so I think that the instruction itself, even in terms of what the court decided, probably didn't accomplish what the court was looking for. And I also think that while we've seen some brakes being put on civil litigation, I think those brakes are very tentative. I don't think that they're reaching deeply into civil litigation at this point. And I still don't think this is a court that has defined itself in those terms.
I was actually disappointed when I found out that this panel was on civil litigation, because what I really wanted to have the opportunity to do was to talk about the most important Supreme Court case of last term, which was the case in which the court unanimously upheld my in-bank dissent. Unfortunately, it's a criminal money laundering case, so I couldn't figure out a way to segue it into this civil discussion, but it's United States versus... Yes, that's right.
Statutory interpretation, you're
right. Yeah, right, exactly. But it's... anyway, United States versus Cuellar, if any of you want to read it. And it's a wonderful opinion by Justice Thomas because it quotes my dissent in several different places. Reminds me of Ken Starr's comment about quoting himself and his dean of Pepperdine, and that I don't know whether you noticed, Ken, but here at the hotel we get a free copy of USA Today, and I'm sure you start your day with USA Today every morning, but you might have missed it because the front page article of the whole USA Today is about one of your law graduates, And unfortunately, it's not because he's one of your law graduates, but because he's the head coach of the number two football team this year. But nonetheless, he can always fall back on a distinguished legal career. I want to talk first about what I think is maybe the second most significant case in terms of legal methodology that's been mentioned, and that is the Ligon Creative Leather Products case, and that's the case that overruled Dr. Miles. And the reason I want to mention that is in terms of trying to examine where the Roberts Court may be going. That's a straight 5-4 under the usual what we might consider the conservative liberal breakdown. I don't need to mention all the justices, but you know what I'm talking about with that particular breakdown. And the interesting thing is that the court, whether in terms of economic analysis it's right or wrong, the court went back and overcame the bar of stare decisis and overruled a 1911 case. Not only overruled a 1911 case, but overruled a case that at least had provided a bright line rule that everyone knew how to apply in favor of a rule of reason, which oftentimes nobody knows how to apply. I'm not suggesting at all that Dr. Miles was rightly decided, but in terms of whether the court is being aggressive in either a liberal conservative way or in terms of a pro or anti-business way, what it did in that case strikes me as most interesting and may indicate to us how the court really feels about stare decisis. On the other hand, the fact that it was 5-4 strictly along what we might term ideological lines indicates that stare decisis doesn't carry much real weight at all where the justices feel strongly that something needs to be changed. Anyway, it's not so much interesting in what they decided in that case, but in terms of how they decided it. Robert Bork was mentioned a few minutes ago appropriately, and I was going to mention in terms of this case that when I was fortunate enough to get my antitrust training from him at Yale, and I remember how he would rail against the Dr. Miles decision at that time, and back then it was only half as old as it is now. But this gives me a little segue into something that's totally irrelevant to our discussion, but Ken told me that I have judicial immunity this morning. So the two things that, well, several things stand out about Judge Bork's fine teaching of antitrust, but one is the vertical restraints that implicated by Dr. Miles, and the other was the fact that back then, this was late 60s, early 70s, you may remember that one of the big enemies of the left was the big three automakers and General Motors. And so there was a lot of concern that the big three automakers needed to be broken up because they were monopolizing the market and for all the usual reasons. And I remember taking a particular seminar on that particular aspect from him. That's interesting in terms of current affairs because this week we're talking about what might happen to the auto industry and whether the federal government should assume a bigger role. And coincidentally this week, you may have noticed that one of the top items in the news, actually it was probably buried on page 73 somewhere, was that, you remember the Yugo that they used to sell here? Good example of what happens when government produces automobiles. Well, this week is very sad. The last Yugo went off the assembly line this week. They've now shut down And it reminded me of some of the old stories about the Yugo, for example. What's another name for a Yugo shock absorber? It's called a passenger. And why do they put a rear window defroster in a Yugo? It's so that your hands will be warm when you're pushing it. And what's another name for a Yugo at the top of a hill? A miracle. And finally, how do you double the value of a Yugo, of your Yugo? You fill the gas tank. Well, anyway, so that just gives me an opportunity to editorialize about what happens when, antitrust policy shifts and we have to be careful about these doctrines, because the big monopolization enemy, the big three automakers, does not pose that kind of danger anymore. Now, shifting away from antitrust, I really do think that the most significant decision that's been discussed is Bell Atlantic versus Trombley, and the reason I say that, it has nothing really to do with the antitrust aspects of that case, but it has to do with the Rule 8 pleading standards. I'm privileged to be one of the editors that works on the Chapter 8 and Rule 8 in Moore's Federal Practice, and we've tried to pay a lot of attention to the change wrought by this case. It's a case that significantly, it was written by Justice Souter. It was a 7-2 split, which indicates that even if the complexion of the court may change somewhat in the next few years, there is likely to be still a majority that will uphold the increased pleading standard under Rule 8, which every civil case is subject to. So I think that case and how the lower courts interpret that in terms of Rule 8 is one of the most significant things that will affect all civil litigation, and that we need to be watchful for. I yield to Roger.
Will. Thank you, Judge Smith. I want to begin by saying I'm amazed at the size of this crowd, given that we're up against the financial bailout panel. I can only assume that none of you has anything left in his 401k, and so you're here to find out how to litigate to get it back. In any event, I was asked just a few days ago to sit on this panel. I'm not sure why, because I have no particular expertise in this area. I'm not going to let that stand in the way of my commenting, though. In any event, given the short notice, when I saw the six different subjects that we were supposed to be covering, I decided to focus on the preemption issues, and that brought to mind a cover I saw some years back on the National Journal when preemption was once again before the country. It had a picture of a large gorilla, and underneath was a quote from a corporate executive, "I'd rather be ruled by one gorilla than 50 monkeys." And that pretty much captures the businessman's sense of preemption. That when you're a national organization, you really don't want to have to deal with these 50 monkeys out there, because it's a gross imposition on inefficiency. But, of course, this brings to the fore the preemption issues, the tension in our federal system between local rule under the state's general police power, especially in health and safety issues, and federal rule under the commerce power plus the supremacy clause. State regulation respects the nation's laboratories of experiment, of course, but it can also frustrate the free trade that the Commerce Clause was written to ensure. I'm going to come back to these grand themes in a few minutes, but first I want to turn to the larger assignment that the panel was given, namely to discuss civil litigation in the Roberts Court. In particular, we were asked consider whether the Roberts Court is pro-business and the implications of its business decisions for the role of the courts adjudicating civil litigation going forward. On the first question, I won't recount the numbers, but it's generally a thought that the Roberts Court is considerably more pro-business than previous courts have been. That absence of evidence to the contrary, however, shouldn't be read normatively, because in his confirmation hearings, then-judge Roberts likened the role of the court to that of an umpire, and if he is serving that role, and I think the evidence suggests that he is, the court is simply enforcing the rule of law rather than putting a thumb on the scale of justice. More interesting, however, is the character of the business decisions. In those same hearings, Roberts expressed the hope that the court would come increasingly to speak with one voice rather than in the fractured voice of 5-4 opinions with multiple opinions. And in the business cases, he seems to be succeeding. In the last term, for example, nearly half the business cases were decided unanimously or with only one dissent, and nearly three-quarters with two or fewer dissents. One of the reasons for those margins in the preemption cases is that the decisions were often narrow and textually based, the point that Carter brought out earlier. Of the six cases last term that turned on preemption, or at least raised the issue, one was decided 9-0, one 8-0, two 8-1, one 7-2, and one split 4-4. In four of those six cases, preemption was upheld, and in all but one of the six, the 4-4 split, involved express preemption or its functional equivalent, which helps to explain, of course, why the court was able to speak with so few dissents. Paradoxically, those narrow decisions create something of a double-edged sword for the businessman. As Dan Troy and Rebecca Wood note in their essay in the preemption cases in this year's Cato Supreme Court Review, a unanimous opinion may make it easier for businesses to plan for risk, but at the same time, narrow consensus opinions may offer little guidance beyond the facts of the case. Well, let me look just quickly at two such cases. In Roe v. New Hampshire Motor Transport Association, the court ruled unanimously that the Federal Aviation Administration Authorization Act means exactly what it says, namely that the states may not enact any law related to motor carrier price, route, or service. Maine had required companies shipping tobacco products into the state to use a delivery service that assumed that assured recipients were at least 18 years old. The state's arguments for an implied public health exception to preemption went nowhere. Public health does not define itself, the court said. That's a point I'll come back to in a moment. Allowing that exception would frustrate uniform standards for national carriers. In Regal Medtronic, which was an 8-1 decision, the court relied on the express preemption provisions of the medical device amendments to the 1976 Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to bar state litigation claims arising from products that had been approved by the FDA after passing FDA's rigorous pre-market approval process. Now, Regal set the stage, of course, for this term's Wyeth v. Levine, which, of course, is one that does not involve any express preemption provision. I assume most of you know the facts, so I'll just summarize them here. Diana Levine, a Vermont musician, lost part of her arm to gangrene after Wyeth's drug, Phenerden, was administered using a delivery technique known as IV push, which inadvertently injected the drug into one of Ms. Levine's arteries. Wyeth, the FDA, and the clinic that administered the drug were all aware of the risks of using the procedure. That's why the label that FDA approved gave clear warning about it. Now, Ms. Levine won her suit against the clinic, but she also filed a state common law suit against Wyeth, claiming that the warning was inadequate because it didn't prohibit IV push delivery. Wyeth answered, invoking so-called conflict preemption, that because the label was approved and mandated by the FDA, the state tort suit was preempted since, A, it was impossible to satisfy the demands of both the FDA and the state common law, and, B, state liability would conflict with the federal objective of the Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act. In a 4-1 decision, the Vermont Supreme Court upheld the jury verdict for Ms. Levine of $6 million, finding, among other things, that because the FDA rules create only minimum labeling requirements, state liability would not frustrate the FDA's objective, the promotion of public health. I'm going to develop that point in just a second. There's a good deal wrong with that decision, much of which came out at oral argument earlier this month in the U.S. Supreme Court. Not surprisingly, Justice Scalia may have made the sharpest point when he noted that if Ms. Levine's main complaint was that the FDA got it wrong in permitting the IV push procedure, then she should be suing the FDA, not Wyeth. Wyeth, in other words, is caught between what Dan Troy and Rebecca Wood called the rock of federal mandates and the hard place of trying to comply with a patchwork of different and competing state law standards. The arguments here are familiar, of course, many of them consequentialist in nature, to do the type of balancing that we need to balance type 1 and type 2 errors, and the relative capacities of expert agencies to do that or lay juries. What I want to focus on, however, is this idea that the FDA establishing simply a floor after which states may increase protection, because there seems to be some confusion surrounding it, and the argument from impossibility, in my judgment, doesn't really bring out the confusion or go to the heart of the matter. So I'm going to start from the other end, from the nation's first principles. I know, Ken, you would be disappointed if I didn't bring up natural law at some place in the course of these proceedings, so I don't want to disappoint you. In any event, you go back to the nation's first principles, and you can come at this from the other direction. When you look at Locke, the Declaration, the Constitution's preamble, you see that we're rooted as a nation in natural rights theory and politically in state of nature theory, whereby we start with a state of affairs devoid of government and try to determine from reason what our rights and obligations are, and including our right to create government in the first place. But before you get to that point, you soon realize that rights theory, grounded in reason, will get you only so far before you have to turn to values to flesh out fully the theory of rights. And there are four classic areas where you discover this: nuisance, risk, which is, of course, what the FDA deals with, remedies, and enforcement. A theory of rights can tell you that if A hits B, A is obligated to make B whole again. It can't tell you what a life or a limb is worth, that's remedies, or what rights A or B has toward that end, that's the enforcement issue. To answer those kinds of questions, you need value judgments, which reasonable people can have reasonable differences about. Hence, you need positive law to complete the picture that begins with natural law. The same is true with nuisance and risk. Reason cannot tell you, for example, how many decibels of noise or quanta of particulate matter mark the line between A's right to active use of his and B's right to the quiet enjoyment of his. That's for courts to determine initially and public law to determine eventually once you get to the large numbers context. And just where we are, that's just where we are with agencies like the FDA that draw those risk lines. Under our federal system, states can draw those lines to a point. But if state regulation leads to the breakdown of free commerce, as was already happening under the Articles of Confederation, then the federal commerce power is there to regulate or make regular commerce among the states, in part by negating state actions that frustrate free trade, but also by crafting such affirmative regulations as are necessary to ensure that end. So what I'm proposing here is perfectly consistent with the original understanding of the commerce power, not simply the post-New Deal understanding of it. Notice, however, that this isn't creating a floor of rights that states may add to. It's drawing a line marking where A's rights end and B's begin. Once the line is drawn, Wyeth has a right to market its drug with a particular warning that gives notice to Ms. Levine and her clinic about the risk of a particular procedure. Once notified, the clinic and Ms. Levine can in turn decide to take the risk or not. What they cannot do is ask the state to redraw the line in their favor. That would amount to giving Ms. Levine a new right to take a risk risk-free and to extinguishing Wyeth's right, its right to be held harmless should the risk materialize after having properly disclosed the risk. In short, the argument about a floor ignores a basic principle of rights theory. There's no such thing as a free ride. So, will the Roberts Court argue along these lines? Someday, perhaps. Not now.
When we began this conversation, it was extremely warm in this room, and there was a lot of light. Now, at least up here, it's totally dark and completely freezing. Could we have more light? And I would like a stadium blanket, please. Well, we've been treated to a very rich conversation. You've heard about the number of cases on the docket, the role of the Chief Justice, a good deal of discussion about punitive damages, skepticism cutting across ideological lines about substantive due process, on procedural due process, perhaps angels dancing on a pin. Social science suggesting maybe there's not such a problem. Employment cases, more pro-employee. And then the very interesting observation, habeas corpus litigation, which is civil litigation, has now been quite vigorously empowered. Perhaps the most important point made, of the unanimous vindication of Judge Smith, but in a criminal case. Perhaps the second most important case, how to keep your hands warm. I became very interested in that issue. I'm looking for a Hugo to push. The importance of Bell Atlantic versus Twombly. That has been a very important theme. The disappearance, at least this last term, of the presumption against preemption and the importance of preemption cases generally, and the unanimous court in some of those cases, and an 8-1 decision in Regal with a very important case involving conflict preemption to come. I made a note about my 401k has disappeared and I should be in some other room listening to another subject about how we can get our money back through civil litigation. The third most important is the importance of a Pepperdine legal education. You too could be a head coach, believe me. If you can make $1.8 million in Lubbock, Texas and not be a plaintiff's lawyer. You can own your own aircraft at that stage. And then the importance of John Locke and the Declaration and natural rights, but still there is a role for positive law, and there's lots of room for your questions and comments. And so we are going to take one, we now have a microphone. Excellent. So if you would be kind enough to even identify yourself and ask a question for one or more of our panelists, we would welcome them. Here we are, Jeremy. A frequent adjunct professor at the Pepperdine University School of Law. Listen with interest to his perceptive question.
I believe one of the panelists said something about being introduced by Dean Starr. I have to concur with that. my question is actually, I think, directed to Carter Phillips, who I believe made the point that the State Farm versus Campbell 1-1 ratio is the most frequently ignored U.S. Supreme Court case than any other. I was wondering if that might be because the issue comes up so more often in state courts than in federal courts, and state courts are less used to following the U.S. Supreme Court or even looking to the U.S. Supreme Court in most of their jurisprudence.
Well, I mean, there's probably something to that, although my experience is that there are a fair number of federal cases in which the 1-1 ratio doesn't seem to get a whole lot of play as well. So, but, you know, I agree with you that in terms of the overall numbers, there's no question as to why that's so. I'm not sure that it's lack of experience so much as just a lack of enthusiasm for the principle that that they're more confined under the Constitution. Fortunately, you know, most of the, at least in state court, there is also the alternative ground that you can avoid the constitutional issue, obviously, by using any of the state standards for remitting the damages, but sadly, that's not followed all that often either.
If I can add something.
Please.
Now, it seems to me that, first of all, the statement in State Farm versus Campbell is about as weak as you can hope. Justice Kennedy wrote that perhaps a 1-1 might be appropriate type of statement. And second of all, on remand, the Utah Supreme Court ended up with a 9-1 ratio, and the court did not take cert after that, and I think that also was a certain signal that some courts took to be more than necessarily it is.
Yes, over here.
Hi, I'm Fred Ansel.
Fred, how are you?
Fine, Judge, how are you?
Doing great, thank you. Good to see you.
Great to see you. You're I'm a big fan of yours and many on the panel. It's a terrific panel. I was a little surprised, but I guess you weren't asked to talk about a major, major area of business, not only civil, but business litigation the Supreme Court has been extraordinarily active in, and that Greg knows the Department of Justice has been extraordinarily successful in, and that is intellectual property. And I'm wondering if any of you are prepared to say anything about the Roberts Court's rulings that might be able to be determined now with respect to intellectual property, if that's okay for me to put it within the general
sure.
area.
Very, very important.
Well, I mean, there's no question that when I clerked for Chief Justice Berger a few years after Ken did, the standard line was that if you were writing a pull memo for the justices as to whether or not to grant certiorari, all you had to do in a patent case was say, this is a patent case. Therefore, recommend cert denied. And that held true for a very long time. The Federal Circuit was created, I think, in 1981 or 1982, and the Supreme Court basically gave that court a pass for the next 20 years, very rarely taking up their cases, largely because they have exclusive jurisdiction in certain areas, and therefore you can't get a split in the circuits, and the court's docket was generally declining anyway. But if you look at the last 3 years in particular, both in the terms of the number of cases that the court has taken, but it, probably more importantly, and Greg may be able to talk to this more, but in terms of the number of requests to the Justice Department to express the views of the United States with respect to certain patent issues, the docket has just exploded. Now, you put exploded in context, but, you know, if you're getting three or four patent cases a term, which is sort of where you are these days, that's out of one every decade in the previous years. So in that sense, there has been a huge uptick. I don't doubt for a moment that the Chief Justice has had to have had a significant influence there, in part because he practiced in the patent law area. He had a number of cases before the Federal Circuit. I don't know whether how that affected his view of the correctness of their decision making, but it certainly probably influenced his view about the importance of intellectual property in general. And that to me is probably the bottom line explanation. Sooner or later, there was going to have to be some effort to analyze some of these issues because intellectual property is such a significant part of our economy that it would just be impossible, I think, for the court to stand by the side and sort of allow that to be decided even by a more specialized court under those circumstances. That, you know, from the business community's point of view, of course, and even more so, I suppose, from patent litigators' perspective, I mean, this is a fairly frightening situation to be in, because principles that have been sort of immutable for the better part of 20 to 25 years, because that's the rule that the Federal Circuit said, are now completely in play. So that while it was absolutely clear to every patent lawyer that if you win infringement, you get, as a matter of natural right, an injunction. That's never been what the statute said, and that's what the Supreme Court had very little difficulty saying in the 9-0 decision. So what they basically said is that if, you know, we're going to look more carefully at what the Federal Circuit is doing, it's not done particularly well on the merits when cases get up there. None of them have the benefit of Judge Smith's experience of interviews affirmed by a unanimous court lately. And so, you know, anytime you're litigating in the patent area, it seems to me you have to worry about the risk that the rules may change on you, even as you from day to day.
Couple thoughts. I think Carter's probably right about the personnel issue and the impact of the new chief. I would think that just given the technological explosion over the last several years, IP becomes that much more central and important, and the court has realized that. It is interesting. I haven't gone back and run the numbers on this, but there does seem to be this phenomenon of sort of the presumption of regularity, as it were, that the Federal Circuit would have as the specialized court in this field sort of dissipating. I think the reversal rates are pretty high, and, you know, court was set up to be specialized and expert in a challenging field, but that idea doesn't seem to have carried over in the way the Supreme Court reviews its decisions. It's a fairly new and interesting but pretty dramatic trend.
May I just add, consistent with what's been said, and thank you for the question, Fred, that the Supreme Court in MedImmune v. Genentech encouraged civil litigation in its interpretation of the Declaratory Judgment Act in a particular context, but a very important context in terms of licensees and the ability to challenge the validity of a patent, notwithstanding the existence of a license that MedImmune very much wanted to continue to be able to employ, but it wanted to both have the license, pay the royalties, but also to be able to bring the Declaratory Judgment Act. Was that a case or controversy? The court said not unanimously, but overwhelmingly, yes, it was. I think only Justice Thomas in dissent with a harder reading of the Declaratory Judgment Act. Yes, Eric.
In my private practice, part of my private practice involves representing...
Oh, you must identify yourself, Eric.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I also am a great admirer of you, Judge.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, you now have standing to ask your question.
Thank you.
You don't need to identify yourself.
Eric Hasso from New Jersey, Boies, Schiller, and Flexner. Part of our practice involves representing whistleblowers in False Claims Act cases, and mm-hmm. given what seems to be the trend of nationalization of industry and so forth, and increasing, presumably, federal involvement and in industry generally, I wonder mm-hmm. what the views are about the future of the False Claims Act, given that on the appellate level and to some more limited degree on the Supreme Court level, it seems like, again, there's been a narrowing of, call it pro-business or what you will, but a narrowing of the standards required to get to trial in these cases.
General Katsas, you want to take first whack?
Huge. It's a huge part of the civil division practice. It's a challenging practice for us because of the key TAM aspects of the statute. We're in a position where a lot of times we have relators pursuing claims on our behalf. Sometimes consistent with the enforcement wishes of the government, but sometimes not, frankly, and that's a very challenging issue for us, sort of trying to figure out when we want to work with the relators, when we want to try to rein them in, when we have competing interests, sometimes competing interests in, on the one hand, maximizing recovery as lawyers for the taxpayer. On the other hand, we have sometimes cross-cutting interests as counsel for an agency that doesn't necessarily want a contractor unduly punished for treble damages under some expansive theory. So they're very challenging cases for us bureaucratically, managing those interests, managing the relators on the one hand and the defendants on the other hand, who by definition are usually people who are one way or another partners with the government. It's hard for me to comment sort of with greater specificity because obviously our position has to vary with our assessment of the interests and merits in particular cases, but I guess I'll also say it's a hot button issue. Senator Grassley has made it his life's work, and we are constantly asked for reports on our enforcement activity in this area.
If I could add, there is an incredibly delicate balance because there may no longer be pockets of constitutional thought to the effect that QI-TAM is facially unconstitutional, as opposed to simply unconstitutional as applied in a particular case. And yet it is, from time to time, a source of considerable recovery for the United States government, and the Civil Division welcomes success. So I've seen it go both ways. All rise because Judge Bea is being recognized. Oh, Judge Bea is rising.
Carlos Bea from San Francisco. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, but don't hold that against me. yesterday, and I'll direct this to whoever in the panel feels strongest about that, although Mr. Katsas has mentioned the case. Yesterday we were told by Professor William P. Marshall, who I had not had the pleasure of meeting earlier, of the University of North Carolina School of Law, I hope I quote him correctly, that as a result of the Seattle school cases, there is no further principled basis upon which anyone can oppose affirmative action. You mentioned that school case. I didn't have as good success as Judge Smith did, but I got four people on the Supreme Court to agree with my dissent from bank. Do you see the future as does Professor Marshall?
I didn't hear the comment yesterday. Just hearing you summarize it, I have difficulty understanding it, frankly, because although earlier I was making the point that I don't think the Seattle schools case can fairly be read as reflecting any dramatic change in precedent, it did strike down the assignments at issue, and I would think, other things equal, it makes arguments for affirmative action harder rather than easier.
Arthur Hellman from Pittsburgh. You mentioned Senator Grassley, who harasses you about false claims litigation.
That's your term, not mine.
I've been at the witness table with him. He also introduces legislation to overrule some court decisions that he feels have been unduly restrictive and have not interpreted the act the way he believes it should be written. This new Congress, we're going to see a lot of legislation introduced to overrule some other Supreme Court decisions. I wonder, particularly those relating to business, I wonder if the members of the panel would care to predict which decisions of the recent Supreme Court they think are most vulnerable to legislative overruling.
Mm. Let the panel reflect on that. I want to pass a bouquet because Professor Hellman is one of the few people in the country who makes a serious study of the Supreme Court not doing its work, my characterization. Of the number of conflicts that are left unaddressed, I heard Carter Phillips speak very directly to this before a sitting justice on the Supreme Court. So would you join me in thanking Arthur Hellman for all that he does to bring the data together? Now, with that, the microphone's very close to you, Bob.
Well, you know, obviously because of her prominence at the Democratic Convention, Lilly Ledbetter, I would think that that would be one of the first and somewhat easiest for the new majority in Congress to address. Whether they address it in a fashion that necessarily answers the question posed by the case itself, I'm not convinced it necessarily follows. I also think that the court will be watching very closely what happens both in Altria versus Good and Weigel versus
Wyeth
versus Levine. And my guess is that Weigel is one of the things that there's a draft at least available and my guess is that we're going to see Congress try to address it. I've got to say that my sense from going to the oral argument in Wyeth was that we're likely to get a very muddy decision rather than anything that I think the legislation will clearly be able to address unless they create a new system of preemption. And I doubt if the Congress is going to have an easy time of addressing it.
Yeah, the speculation that I've seen is that Wyeth, depending on how it comes out, is this microphone working? Yes.
Yeah,
yes. Okay. Is a candidate for legislation, but I agree with Bob. I don't know how they're going right now it's of course implicit, not express preemption, and so what are they going to do? Does anybody know what direction such litigation is going to take, or legislation rather?
Perhaps they will say that there can no longer be obstacle preemption under Hines versus Davidowitz because that's an issue for Congress to determine whether something stands as an obstacle to the achievement and accomplishment of the purposes of Congress. With that, Carter.
First of all, I got to get my breath back. I mean, I think there's a serious question whether or not the Congress will revisit indirect liability under the securities laws. The central bank and the Stone Ridge were wonderfully great decisions for the defendants on the securities side, but particularly in the wake of Enron and with the market having now done a complete reversal, the likelihood of some push to try to expand liability, I think, is going to be quite substantial, and it'll probably be justified because they'll say that, well, the SEC already has the authority to enforce indirect liability, and unfortunately the SEC's too busy dealing with all the other issues of the day, and so what you really need are the private attorneys general to get out there. You know, I always have mixed feelings about these things because, on behalf of my clients, I feel bad for it. On behalf of myself, it's not the worst thing that could happen.
Yes.
Judge Starr, and may it please the panel. My name's Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute, and I have a question about something that makes it onto the front page of USA Today almost as much as college football, and that's the Dormant Commerce Clause. And I should preface this, I guess, with some pandering to the moderator because of the big win in the Wine Wars case that I heard about on Wednesday, I believe, in Massachusetts, which I certainly will be tracking. And
let freedom ring.
if it doesn't settle, I think it would be an interesting cert vehicle on this. But do any of the panelists
don't
have
tell Carter.
Do any of the panelists have any views on what the Roberts Court, where it's going on Dormant Commerce Clause? Last term there was one kind of quixotic case involving the state taxation of railroad bonds in Kentucky, but on the broader scale, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's a very, in the last two terms, there have been Dormant Commerce Clause cases where it does seem as though this is one area where Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito don't necessarily see eye to eye. And, in some ways it goes back to the comment I made before. What are their federalism interests and how do they come at these things? Obviously, there is one perspective that says Dormant Commerce Clause never should have started in the first place, and the whole idea of courts stepping in here is disturbing. I'm still thinking about Ken's suggestion we're getting rid of Hines versus Davidowitz.
I said they might want to.
Just as a concept, it's just being very distressing to me. But that would be more than remarkable. But the flip side of that, is just dealing with the Commerce Clause issues along the lines that Roger was talking about. That's an area where you could say, Congress really ought to step in, which is why conflict preemption wouldn't seem to me at least nearly as disturbing. But I think the bottom line is it's way too soon in this court to be able to tell how they're going to break out on the Dormant Commerce Clause, even in the area of the wine fight, because I do think that's going to make its way back to the court sometime in the next 5 to 10 years.
May I add that Justice Alito is very deeply Hamiltonian and agrees with Justice Kennedy, who previously served on the distinguished Ninth Circuit. And one of the things that has not been said here on this panel thus far, that this is, quote, the Kennedy Court. At most of these gatherings, you hear, well, this is the Justice Kennedy Court. And we can discuss that and debate it. But there's one area in this Dormant Commerce Clause area where Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito are fervently Hamiltonian in terms of the power of Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. Justice Scalia, as we know, has become agnostic, and I'm very sorry to say that Justice Thomas has become a complete atheist when it comes to the Dormant Commerce Clause. There comes a time when you should respect stare decisis, and if it was mentioned in Gibbons versus Ogden and then picked up in the 1850s, it should be settled law that there is a place for the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence, unless Congress says we do not want such jurisprudence. But Justice Thomas has dug his heels in and says, bah humbug to all Dormant Commerce Clause cases because of his concerns about judicial power, and we understand those concerns. Last question, Manny. Manny, could you wait for the microphone? I'm sorry, we're videoing
Manny,
this.
Manny Klausner from Los Angeles. I'd like to ask Carter Phillips if he has any special insights from his experience at Sidley, whether there may be some new executive orders that affect civil litigation from our president-elect.
The answer is no.
On that very clear, appellate advocates are taught
answer yes, no, and then elaborate. That was the perfect answer. Would you join me in saying thank you to our panel?